Now, In Depth with Francis Rose.
Thanks for listening and welcome to the program for Friday, January 30th, 2015. It's the Federal News Countdown, the three most important federal news stories of the week. And my guests on this week's Federal News Countdown are both rookies, so I promise, friends, to be very nice to you this week. I appreciate you both coming in. Nora Bensahel of American University, it's great to have you. This is the first time that I've had you on my program in your new gig. You've been on with Tom Temin on the Federal Drive earlier this week. You were terrific, by the way. But you're now at American University, and tell me what you were doing there with General Dave Barno, another friend of the show.
Yeah, we're at the School of International Service at American University. We're going to be writing a book on military adaptation and teaching and doing a few other things. We also just started a column in War on the Rocks, the blog that'll come out every other Tuesday, so we're really excited.
Excellent. Congratulations. It's terrific to have you here, and welcome to the Federal News Countdown. My other guest on the program today is an off-time guest on the show, but never on the countdown before. It's Brian Clark of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. It's great to see you, Brian.
Thank you. It's great to be on, Francis.
You both have chosen terrific stories as your three most important federal news stories of the week. And we start where we always do with...
Number three!
And Nora, your choice at number three is from the New York Times. The headline is, Kurd Militia Says ISIS Expelled from Kobani. This is an important place in Syria, and this is significant for a number of reasons. What in particular, what aspect of the story made it significant to you this week?
The fight in Kobani has been going on for about 3 months, and what happened this week is the Kurdish forces, as supported by U.S. air power, finally were able to take control of the town again, at least 90% of the town. Kobani itself is not that strategically important, but it has taken on huge significance because it's very, very close to the Turkish border. And that has made it, quite consequential in the fight against ISIS because Turkey obviously plays a very big role in that. What I think is notable about it, though, in some ways, is it shows just how hard the fight against ISIS is. It's a relatively small place, again, strategic location, but not the most important area that ISIS has taken over. And it took 3 months to get the coordination between the Kurdish forces operating there and U.S. air power to work together in synergy to push them back. I actually think that demonstrates how hard the fight against ISIS is on the battlefield, what it takes to get effective coordination. And if we're talking about a larger piece of territory that may have more strategic significance to ISIS, not geostrategically, but mm-hmm. in terms of, tactics and operations, it shows that it can be done, but really quite how difficult it is.
And that's a potentially very complicated implication for strategy and policy that we would set in the United States, and not just for in a couple of years. That implies to me this is a much longer fight, a longer war than we probably thought we were getting into a year and a half ago.
That's right. It will be a long-term project. Obviously the fight against ISIS is complicated extensively by the Syrian civil war. The United States is starting to send some training aid to some of the Syrian forces, much slower off the mark than some had hoped, perhaps. But again, it does show that this is going to be, this isn't going to be over anytime soon, and that the coordination with the local forces that the U.S. is providing, although is critically important, but very difficult to get right.
The New York Times has Nora Bensahel's choice as the third most important federal news story of the week. Kurd militia says ISIS expelled from Kobani. Brian, your choice at number three this week is from Defense News, and the headline is Air Force Vice Chief to Scientists, Help Us. This is a call that's not just happening in the Air Force, and it's not just happening with the scientific community. It is happening all over the Pentagon to just about every core of advanced academia and nonprofits and the vendor community and everybody. I mean, it seems like there's a message that emanated from OSD. I don't know that there was, but it seems like there was a message that emanated from OSD. Ask anybody you can to help us in any way they can. Am I on target there?
Exactly. And that's why I chose this article, because it was just the latest in a number of calls from DOD leaders to the scientific and industrial community asking for help with high technologies that are going to enable the Department of Defense to get an edge on potential competitors in a budget environment where they're not going to be able to spend their way out of the potential challenges they've got. So when you look at countries like China and then a resurgent Russia that have technologically savvy militaries that are able to field pretty high-end weapons and surveillance systems. The U.S. in the past has been able to rely on its technological edge, like with the Soviet Union. And this third offset strategy that Deputy Secretary of Defense Bob Work has put out is really focused on leveraging that same technological edge we've relied on in the past to try to make us able to overcome the numerical advantage that a potential competitor like a China might have. Or their geographic advantage, you know, because if we are going to have a conflict with them, it's likely to be closer to China than it is to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So high technology is seen as the panacea that's going to enable the DoD to be successful. At the same time, what's happened is our research and development base within DoD has sort of lagged in a way behind what's happening in commercial industry, because if you see the kind of technology you have available in your iPad or your iPhone today, it's far in excess of what the average soldier or average sailor is able to tap into, because the cycle within industry to make technological advancements is much faster than what the military is able to mount. So you've seen this change from DoD being the leader in technology development to commercial industry being the technology leader. And that's why DoD is reaching out to industry to try to get some ideas for how they can get the technological edge back.
And the potential problem there is they may get to a point, and some vendors already think they've gotten to a point, where the message between the lines, not explicit but implicit, is become our R&D shop. And we expect you to do it all. Show us what you've got. And a lot of vendors are very apprehensive about that, I guess.
Definitely. And so in the research I've been doing on some various studies we got going on over at CSBA, one of the items of feedback I've received from industry is we're reducing our internal research and development because of the reductions in DoD budgets and the reduction in procurement, because that's the source of that money. They will take a percentage of what they get in procurement funds from DoD and use that to fund internal research and development for seed money for projects they would do in an attempt to create a product that DoD will eventually want.
Mm-hmm.
Well, without as much procurement money, they're not going to have as much money for internal R&D, and they're telling DoD, well, I'm not going to be your R&D shop because,
right,
I can't afford it, and two, my shareholders will not let me put that kind of money at risk to build something in the hopes that perhaps you buy it,
mm-hmm,
when with sequestration and the budget caps, you may not be able to.
Well, and the other driver, DoD says it's an excuse, and the vendors say it's a reason. But the other thing behind that's LPTA, and the perception, at least, that that's driving decision-making in the Pentagon. Well, why would I invest a lot of money in something new and innovative if they're just going to buy whatever the cheapest thing is anyway?
Right, right. So the bid process, the competition that DoD wants is going to tend to drive companies out that would offer a product that perhaps is more expensive but more innovative technologically. The other part of this is there's this expectation on the part of DoD leaders that a commercial industry is going to somehow yield some significant military benefits. So things like big data that's going to offer the ability to process large amounts of information and the increasing miniaturization of computing power, that those are going to somehow yield military advantages, which may be true, but then there's got to be a significant amount of military-funded R&D that translates computing power into better anti-submarine warfare sensors or something.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not an automatic transition, unlike you might see in the commercial world, where you can harvest those new technologies much more easily.
Brian Clark's choice for the third most important federal news story of the week's from Defense News. The headline is U.S. Air Force Vice Chief to Scientists, Help Us. You can find that story and all the choices on this week's Federal News Countdown linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. When we come back, the second most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Brian Clark and Nora Bensahel, it's the Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose. We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Nora Bensahel of American University and Brian Clark of CSBA. And Brian, your choice for the second most important federal news story of the week is from Breaking Defense. The headline is A Better Way to Buy Nuclear Submarines. A part of this is tied to the discussion about the budget that we'll see on Monday. And President Obama, the White House, OMB, releasing that in the morning. We'll have full coverage of that throughout the day on Federal News Radio and federalnewsradio.com. But what do we know about buying nuclear submarines, one of the most celebrated parts of the defense portfolio, that we should be applying other places across the weapons system spectrum, Brian?
Right. So I didn't just select this because I'm a submariner, although that brought it to my attention initially. But this article was really interesting for a couple of reasons. It was written by two guys that are from the Plowshares Fund, which is a disarmament organization mostly. And normally a group like that would argue for divesting of a capability like a ballistic missile submarine or a nuclear submarine because it's a pretty powerful weapon of war. But what they're arguing is that the Navy should be forced to buy the new ballistic missile submarine within its existing shipbuilding budget. And the reason they're arguing that is because last year in the defense appropriation, Congress created a new fund that the Navy could use to fund the construction of the new ballistic missile submarine separate from its shipbuilding account to allow that money to be protected from being ravaged for other shipbuilding programs. Because one concern that the Navy has and that some Congress members have mentioned is if you force the Navy to pay for this new ballistic missile submarine, which is a national asset, a national responsibility, then they're going to be forced to take away some destroyers or perhaps not buy some other submarines or not buy some carriers. So what these guys are arguing is that the new ballistic missile submarine should be paid for out of the normal shipbuilding budget to compel the Navy to make those trades, because if it forces this strategic discussion of how important is a ballistic missile submarine relative to other kinds of submarines or other ships that are in the Navy's portfolio. The other thing it brought up, which the reason I thought of it was, is several members of Congress have noted to me that that in the defense committees, the biggest challenge they have right now in terms of addressing the Budget Control Act and sequestration is you've got people on the left who would prefer defense spending go down no matter what. And they say they've got people on their right that would prefer that defense spending go down. And they're both arguing it from different perspectives. So people like the Plowshares guys are arguing that we should be divesting of some military capabilities in the interest of promoting peace around the world we don't need them to deal with the situation that we're in right now in the world. And then the people on the right are arguing we need to divest of some of these capabilities to make our economy stronger and allow us to have a stronger national security in the end. But this points to the fact that there's challenges on both the right and the left in terms of trying to create more room in the budget to get rid of the caps and address sequestration. In terms of buying submarines and what might be a better way to buy submarines, today what the Navy does is it buys two submarines approximately a year and does that through multi-year procurements that stretch over several years. Now, there's been a lot of people out there that argue we should be buying submarines more like we bought ships back in the 80s, back when John Lehman was the Secretary of the Navy, and we did the Reagan buildup. We would buy a bunch of a type of ship in 1 year, and then the next year buy a bunch of a different kind of ship. So you'd buy three or four submarines in a given year, and then maybe the next year only buy one, and then you'd buy five or six destroyers in that year. And their argument would be that that gives you a better price because you're able to go to the contractors and say, here's all your money for all these ships, go buy all of your supplies, all of the equipment that you need on the ships, and you get this economic order quantity type thing through this multiple ship procurement.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that also comes out of this, is that if you were to go to that alternative contracting method for ships, you might yield a lot more savings than you get today by buying one or two a year stretched out over several years.
I see two things in this piece, Nora, that you and I have talked about before. One of them is this fund, the Sea-Based Strategic Deterrence Fund, reminds me of, at least from the way some members of Congress are talking about it, as Brian alluded to, reminds me of the Overseas Contingency Operation Fund, or what it's kind of turned into, not what it was originally intended to do, just a way to stick extra stuff in somewhere if you can't get it into the base budget. The other thing that this reminds me that we've talked about before is the whole problem of trying to decide whether you tie capabilities to budget or budget to capabilities or try to knit them together at the same time. and how each affects the other as far as what you wind up with.
Yeah, I think you're right on both of those points. And, you know, of course, the answer to do you tie the budget to capabilities or capabilities to budget is yes, right? You have to do both, but it's an incredibly, incredibly tricky thing to do.
Mm-hmm. The problem with that, too, is we've seen a number of budget documents and we've seen a number or budget opinion type policy documents. And we've also seen a number of strategy documents in the past three, 4 years. And you could make a case, I suppose, that they're linear, but they're not all entirely the same. And so there is still a little bit of a question, I suppose, in Congress about what's next. I mean, when was the last time we heard much about the rebalance to Asia? That's kind of disappeared in terms of strategy discussions. Am I right?
I think you're not hearing a lot about that in public. I mean, especially because that's not, you know, the headlines are dominated by the urgent issues of today, whereas, you know, rebalancing to Asia is deliberately a longer term posturing of which the military is really only a small piece, important but small. I mean, it does have more to do with diplomacy and economics. But, you know, DOD is finding out, as are the other agencies, that, you know, anytime, and this is recurrent throughout, you know, American history, anytime you try to focus on the long term, you find out that the short term crises come up and, you know, divert your attention. That's the way that our system works, unfortunately, you know, in terms of the long term planning.
Brian? You know, another example of that, too, is this brings up the fact that we have this recapitalization of the nuclear enterprise looming. You know, both the Minuteman ICBMs have to be recapitalized and the ballistic missile submarines. GAO just came out with a report talking about how many billions of dollars that's going to be. And it goes into the hundreds of billions of dollars to recapitalize these ships and the Minuteman missiles, which will have to happen here in the next 20 years. That's a long-term bill that we have to address, and we're not really preparing ourselves for it because of the short-term exigencies that are consuming all of our defense money now, which is the overseas contingencies and the purchasing the equipment that we're buying today.
We just have a minute or so left on this story, but that's where I wanted to go next. I wonder if it's a silver lining, Nora, that the Navy is in a position to say, this is the amount of money we have, and we need to fit our purchases to that amount of money, because that would make a terrific case then to go to the Hill and say, well, you gave us this amount of money. This is what we can buy for that amount of money. If that's not enough capability for you, then you got to figure out a way to give us more money.
Yes, and they will certainly make that case. Mm-hmm. Whether Congress responds to that is up in the air. I mean,
right, you know, there's nothing they can do about
that. That's been the argument from a lot of the services for a long time. But, you know, the services have said, all of them, not just the Navy, that, you know, the difficulties, and we'll talk more about this coming up, but the difficulties with the current budget environment is not so much the reductions, it's the unpredictability of the reductions. And, you know, if they can just have a target number and have the latitude to implement it as they see fit, sticking point with Congress, you know, they can make that work. And I think this is one of the areas where, you know, having a set number, you know, they can, as you said, clearly make a case for what the capability delivers and then say, you know, if you don't like that answer, don't look at us.
Mm-hmm. Brian Clark's choice says the second most important federal news story of the week is from Breaking Defense, a better way to buy nuclear submarines. Nora, your choice at number two this week is my colleague Jason Miller's story, Cost Doesn't Factor Heavily in Military Compensation Panel Recommendations, from federalnewsradio.com. 15 suggestions that we got from the Comp Commission yesterday. Are there some of them that you say as you read them, oh, we could definitely do, I could see that happening, or, huh, I'm not so sure about that one, or were there some where you said there's no way in the world that's ever going to happen?
Yeah, I chose this one despite the headline. It's a really good story, but because I wanted to highlight the issue at stake here. This isn't just another commission that's reporting out, because there are zillions of government commissions.
Mm-hmm.
The future of military pay and benefits is one of the most fundamental questions for the future of the defense budget. Right now, military pay and benefits takes up a third of the entire defense budget. If you add in DOD civilians, that number goes up to 45% of the entire defense budget. One of Brian's colleagues at CSBA, Todd Harrison, has done some analysis that shows if the pay and benefits increase at the rate that they have since 9/11, you know, during the current wars, the entire defense budget, every single penny, will go to military pay and benefits by the year 2039. Which is not that far away, mm-hmm. In terms of that kind of a massive issue.
Right.
So something has to be done in order to rein in those costs in a way that is fair to current service members and retirees. This commission was founded as a way, partially, to be honest, to punt the issue down the road a couple of years when it was founded, but also to look at pay and benefits in a more comprehensive way that looks not just at medical costs and retirement, which are really the big drivers here, much in the same way that Social Security and Medicare are in the civilian society and the rest of U.S. government, but also to look at a bunch of other things to weigh how various members of the services look at them and value them. The two big things coming out of this are a recommendation to move the retirement payments to a more 401k-like system. Right now, in order to get any retirement benefits at all, you have to serve 20 years in the military. If you serve 19 years and 364 days, you leave the military with no retirement benefits at all. That means that 83% of the people who serve in the military get no retirement benefits at all. So the call to move to a more 401k type program, does benefit a whole lot more military service members.
Mm-hmm.
It does also, the proposals from the commission also do keep, additional benefits if you do retire at 20 years. They're less than before. I should say, first and foremost, that their recommendations grandfather in everybody who is a current retiree or is serving. So this will only affect future entrants. Sometimes that's not made clear, and that generates a lot of opposition. But there's some really tricky things with how that happens over 20 years, including that, unlike today, that payment for those who do serve 20 years would not be immediate upon retirement. It would be held until retirement age, mm-hmm. and it's not clear what that would be, but something in the realm of 60, most likely. If you get out at 20 years of service and you entered the service at 22, you're entitled to 50% of your pay at that rate at age 42 for the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
This would basically delay that for 18 years-ish until age 60. So that's a really big deal.
Mm-hmm.
On the health side, I think this one probably is DOA. On the medical side, they recommend effectively getting rid of the TRICARE program and shifting most military, certainly retirees and other people as well, onto effectively the equivalent of the civilian government plan.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's politically going to be a non-starter, even though it might be a more logical use of resources and, by effectively consolidating those two programs.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that one's just going to generate so much political opposition that one's going to be a really hard sell.
I'm asking this as I honestly don't know the answer. It's not a rhetorical question. Do retirees feel the same way about TRICARE that folks like my parents who are now retired feel about their Medicare? I mean, my parents love their Medicare and can't imagine living without it and understand the arguments for and against and on and on and on. But how do people feel about that, Brian?
They're pretty happy with it. retirees that are on TRICARE, by and large, really like the service.
Mm-hmm.
It's like going to a regular commercial healthcare company.
And programs well administered
company.
And all
it's
that
well
jazz.
Administered, and the healthcare you get is top notch. You're going to the same place that military members and their dependents are going,
mm-hmm.
so there's a level of service and attention that's commensurate with what you do for military active duty members. So they like it by mm-hmm. and large. I think one thing that's interesting is with the Affordable Care Act, the changes that prevent pre-existing conditions from precluding you from getting a new insurance policy, that was one of the big reasons why retirees wanted to have the option of going on TRICARE, because it enabled you to go from the military
mm-hmm.
to TRICARE. And if you brought with you a number of service-related illnesses or whatever, you would have insurance for the rest of your life and you didn't have to worry about that
mm-hmm.
Because it didn't used to be the fact that you can go to civilian health care insurance company and get health care. Well, now you can. So the idea of going on to the government civilian plan may not be as big an issue.
Right.
I agree that politically it'd be a challenging, but in terms of the realities of it, it may not be that big an issue.
Well, you've navigated this personally. I mean, you transitioned from the Navy uniform side to the Navy civilian side. And so you've been on both sides of that.
Right.
How do you look at this personally as somebody who was actually a consumer of this?
Right. Well, I found the TRICARE system and the civilian health insurance I have now are very equivalent. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's almost indistinguishable in terms of the level of service between the two, and the administration of them is very good.
Nora?
This is absolutely true, but there's a real budgetary difference between the two, and it's a policy issue. It has nothing to do with the health of, you know, people who have served their country, which everybody agrees, you know, is a really important priority. Mm-hmm. Congress has not let the premiums for TRICARE increase significantly since 1995, and what that means is that the expense of TRICARE is going up even more than the comparable civilian health care costs, which are, of course, everybody knows are mm-hmm. going up, because those premiums are one-tenth of what they are on the civilian side, which means the people who retire, for example, at age 42 or whatever, you know, the age is, and are eligible for civilian health insurance, turn it down mm-hmm. because it's, you know, 90% more expensive.
Right.
So the costs of TRICARE are escalating exponentially because of a policy decision, not because of the delivery of health care or health care is getting more expensive yeah. primarily.
That's the Bob Gates eating us alive comment from yeah. 2010, I think it was. Nora, Bensahel's choice as the second most important federal news story of the week is my colleague Jason Miller's story at federalnewsradio.com. Its headline, Cost Doesn't Factor Heavily into Military Compensation Panel Recommendations. You can find it and all of our stories on this week's countdown linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Brian Clark and Nora Bensahel. It's the Federal News Countdown. Be right back. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week. Nora Bensahel of I keep thinking of your old job, Nora. I apologize for that. You're now at American University, and Brian Clark of CSBA choosing the three most important federal news stories of the week, and we're up to
number one.
And Brian, your choice at number one is Gordon Leubold and Molly O'Toole's piece in Defense One about the Military Comp Commission. I'm struck by the response from the military advocacy groups, like this story quotes Nor Bryan from MOA and others, who I expected a lot more forceful reaction from.
Right.
You know, Norm's not shy about saying what he thinks if he thinks somebody might be doing something to ding the people that he cares about. And it was all of the responses, not just his, but all of the responses were very subdued. And I wonder if that has to do with what we talked about a moment ago off the air, which is I came away from this exercise with a sense that the Comp Commission wanted to be able to say yesterday, as they did, we listened to every voice in this community that we possibly could. And in order to present something that will benefit them as much as possible and alienate as few of them as possible. Is that the sense that you took away from this?
Definitely, definitely. That was one of the reasons I picked up on this article, was the fact that it pointed out how the veteran service organizations had been somewhat muted in their resistance to it because of the outreach that the commission had done during the deliberation process. In particular, they were all taking this wait and see attitude toward whether they're going to lodge any protests or go to Congress with some counter proposals. But this goes to the fact that a lot of the proposals that came out of the commission were pretty modest. You know, they didn't propose dramatic changes in military pay, except for perhaps the discussion we had about retirement benefits. They didn't come back with significant changes to the TRICARE copay system for the active duty people or for the dependents. There would be some increase with those for the retirees. So it looks like retirees are going to bear some of the brunt of this. Future retirees will bear some of the brunt of these changes. And then also I like the idea of going at the commissaries and exchanges, which DOD's for years been trying to get commissaries and exchanges changed or taken out of the DOD entirely to save the cost, because commissaries in particular cost DOD a fair amount of money to operate.
Mm-hmm.
Exchanges cost less money because they provide physical plant and some of the facilities and force protection. But the idea of consolidating those and shifting some of the costs onto the companies that will run them themselves is a good idea, and that's going to save the DOD a surprisingly large amount of money as part of this compensation package.
One potential byproduct of this, Nora, that I think is very encouraging, this story in Defense One has a quote from Vice Admiral Bill Moran, the Chief of Naval Personnel, and he says, "I'm hopeful the commission's efforts challenge those of us in leadership to look at the future differently and to more thoughtfully consider the needs of our future force. I believe the debate must advance beyond pay and compensation to consider how we manage people writ large." Now, that term future force, I think, is probably the key out of that entire quote. And Admiral John Harvey, one of Admiral Moran's predecessors in that job, has talked to me before about that concept of the future force, and not just pay and benefits is one bucket, and workforce training and skills development is another bucket, and all everything. It needs to all be knitted together. And if this pushes that, then it strikes me, even if none of the provisions ever become the policy that the Pentagon follows, that's a benefit.
I agree with that. I think Admiral Moran is spot on. You know, it's, pay and benefits is not, or compensation writ large is not enough to be tackling on its own. It's important, but it gets to a much larger issue of talent management, and which the military has not traditionally done well, still very much stuck in industrial age processes of allocating human talent and rewarding people. A problem that's going to be exacerbated as more and more millennials, you know, enters the military services and as they, you know, get promoted through the ranks. I have to say on the you know, retirees organizations and MOA and all that, I'm too cynical, but I think that this is a, you know, a tactical pause while they wait to see what the reaction is, while they, you know, wait to hear some feedback, get some preliminary views from lawmakers on this. I don't see that they're going to be supportive at all of most of this because, you know, from their perspective, I think it will cut too much, even though, as I said, their entire population is grandfathered in. It will not affect a single person in their constituencies. You know, they have very strongly said when, you know, any of these issues have come up before, their rallying cry is, you know, we can't break faith with those who have served. And of course, they're right. Nobody wants to do that. Everyone wants people who have retired or served in the military to be well taken care of and compensated for their service to this country. But, you know, under a constrained budget environment, it is becoming more and more a matter of needing to also keep faith with those who are currently serving by giving them the readiness, you know, and the training they need, and not cutting capabilities to such an extent, you know, because of the pressures from the compensation issues.
But I think the numbers might be where the argument can be won here. I'm going to go back to your choice at number two, Nora. Jason Miller's story. Bob Daigle, executive director of the commission, offered an example of an E-7 who retired after 20 years in the military. That E-7's defined benefit lifetime annuity would drop from $201,000 to $161,000, but with the TSP investment retention bonus that's proposed here as part of this, and the government's contribution to the TSP, that same E-7 would end up with $248,000. So that's it. I mean, it becomes an ROI discussion at that point, doesn't it, Brian?
Definitely. The other thing to think about is what is it that retains somebody in the service? Because to a great degree, that's what the military is looking at, is am I going to be able to bring in, like Admiral Moran was mentioning, the most talented people possible and continue to attract them as the economy improves and jobs become more plentiful on the outside? Right now, compensation within the military is pretty commensurate with compensation in the civilian world. In the surveys that we've done within the Navy, at least, we found that pay for senior enlisted and senior officer, you know, 03 to 06 officers, was in the 80th percentile of their civilian counterparts. Now, a lot of that's because they're technical people and their technical counterparts get paid pretty well as well. But that's one of the things, the bigger drivers of retention is the current pay and benefits that members are receiving. Mm-hmm. And then as they get further along in the service, then the retirement consideration becomes a greater concern. So I think for your senior people to stay maybe from 18 to 23 in there, that the how much retirement pay they're going to get is going to be an issue. But to get people to the point of making that decision at the 15 or so year point, it's more about what they're getting today. And the other thing I'll bring up is Admiral Moran has brought up the point before of quality of service is just as important as quality of life to these guys, particularly millennials. The compensation and the quality of life they have in the service is important, but it's just as important that they feel like they're doing something useful and that they're actively doing it. And we can talk about that with regard to the next story of is the quality of service going to suffer if we have sequestration or budget reductions?
The final thought on this, Nora, is that there's a thread that's run through every story that we've talked about, even the first one, your story on ISIS in Kobani, and that's Congress and their willingness or lack thereof to make a decision and execute that decision on how to do these policies. And ultimately, if Congress decides to do nothing about any of these 15, maybe we do have that byproduct I mentioned a moment ago, where the branches themselves at least start to think about how they manage personnel. But ultimately, no substantive changes probably come out of this. And it's been just another commission that puts a report out and the notebooks sit on the wall for a while.
Right. I think that's right. But it would also involve Congress to deal with any of the personnel systems that are in place, right? One of the biggest problems that gets in the way of the services being able to make those adjustments, being able to be nimble, trying to retain people through non-financial things, such as, you know, if you're a high performer, maybe you get some, you know, more choice about your assignments, for example. That gets to the quality of life. You know, Congress has required a very strict performance review system, in effect. It's not what it's called, but where you're judged against members of, you know, the year of your commissioning, and you are evaluated in lockstep throughout your career. There are certain wickets you need to clear in order to be promoted. You know, a lot of the services have some very innovative ideas on how to do this, but the biggest obstacle is they can't do it under the current law that requires that. So even there, yes, I mean, anything that gets the services to be more creative and think about this, I think some of them are wrestling with it already. Admiral Moran is actually at the lead of that. He's got some, you know, terrific ideas that he's talking about in public. But even that will require Congress to change legislation, and, you know, that's going to be a difficult sell.
Brian Clark's most important federal news story of the week is from Defense One. Military Compensation Reform Commission prompts a divisive debate, and you can read it and all of our stories at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The Federal News Countdown wraps up next with Nora Bensahel's choice as the most important federal news story of the week, next on Federal News Radio. This is In Depth with Francis Rose, the Federal News Countdown, featuring the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Brian Clark and Nora Bensahel. And Nora, your choice at number one will wrap up this week's Federal News Countdown. It's also from Defense One, and it's headlined, Obama to propose Pentagon spending boost in 2016. Now, the White House has been telegraphing this for a while. We have seen hints and clues that they would want to go over the cap for the budget request here. It seems to me they're doing a very nice favor for the folks in Congress on both sides of the aisle that want to increase defense spending. They appear to be handing them an olive branch and saying, here's an opportunity for us to work together. And yet they still have the overall budget hawks that they've got to deal with. Am I on track with what you're seeing here?
I actually see it differently.
Okay.
I see that there's no chance that Congress is going to lift the sequestration caps, even though I think a majority of people in both chambers and even in both parties would like to do so, because the legislation is tied in with domestic spending. You can't just increase the defense budget. You'd have to go back and revisit all the domestic program spending, and there is no consensus there. So what I think is going to continue to happen is we're going to have this ugly fight over the base budget. Congress will probably continue to use the overseas contingency operations as a way to plus up the defense budget, right? That's allocated on a year-by-year basis, ostensibly for overseas operations, but, you know, a lot of stuff that is not directly related to overseas operations has been put in there over the years. But that's not the same as money you can count on in planning. The reason why I think this is the most important story of the week is that, you know, the budget that's proposed ignores what the current law is, which requires the budget, the base budget, and again, not including that overseas contingency operations, to be $500 billion. The president apparently is going to request a $534 billion base budget. You add the overseas money to it, and it comes up to a total of $585. But again, you know, that money is calculated a bit differently. It's not subject to those caps, which means there's going to be a fight over $34 billion that the administration has proposed in spending that Congress has said in law that they can't have and is probably not going to change the law. So we're in a situation that we've been in for the past couple of years, which is going to means we're going to fight over those numbers probably through December of 15. You know, the appropriations never, the budget never gets passed at the beginning of the government fiscal year. And it's the real damage of this is not the debate over the numbers as much as the uncertainty that creates. The services cannot plan on how to allocate money effectively, on how to allocate cuts when it's going to be up in the air, probably well into the new fiscal year, what the budget is going to be because the president requested more than what the legal caps are.
Brian, I'm a cynic, but I do try to find the silver lining when I can. Is it encouraging to you at all that we're starting this discussion at the end of January, beginning of February, rather than beginning, middle, end of March, as we have the last couple of years?
Definitely. That last time we had this discussion, and we ended up being sequestered in fiscal year 13, mm-hmm. This conversation was happening much later and into the new fiscal year. So we were already into the fiscal year in question when the budget discussion broke down and the DOD ended up being sequestered and having to take money out of its existing budget that it already obligated for other purposes. So having it now is better. But I agree with Nora, the chances of DOD, or rather the Congress, coming to an agreement on how to deal with the caps is very unlikely. The last time in the FY14 and FY15 budget, the bipartisan budget agreement that the Murray-Ryan deal that was worked out sort of at the last minute, but in the budget was done by raising some revenue elsewhere in the budget to allow the defense budget to rise without necessarily addressing the domestic budget. So that was they did some shenanigans to create some more money to allow the defense budget to rise. Mm-hmm. Well, those mechanisms are not available a second time now to go get that money. And that would also require a lot of new Republicans that have come into Congress to agree to revenue enhancements to be able to fund increases in defense. So there's just a lot of moving parts that would have to come into place for DOD to get this level of funding. What I fear is going to happen is that the Congress could still appropriate something around this level of funding to DOD, and we could go into fiscal year 16 with a budget that's or an amount of money being given to DOD that is going to be subject to sequester, mm-hmm. which would come into play next year. So almost halfway through the fiscal year, maybe a third of the way through the fiscal year, DOD would be sequestered and the amount of money it has would be cut in the middle of the fiscal year it's already executing.
We just have a minute or so left. Closing question, and the answer can change, I suppose, from week to week, month to month, year to year. Is the uncertainty of not knowing, Nora, worse, or is a top line of around 500,000 or 500 billion worse for the Department of Defense?
Well, it depends who you ask in the Department of Defense, right? Obviously, okay. This budget reflects a calculation that it's better to ask for what you think you need mm-hmm. and to defend that. But if you talk to the individual service chiefs who are the ones who are tasked with actually implementing these cuts, they'll say that, you know, they can manage risk, but, you know, some certainty would help.
Brian?
The uncertainty is worse. If you were able to know beforehand you were going to be down to 500 billion, you could have planned for that over the last couple of fiscal years.
Okay, 10 seconds then. Is it possible that somewhere in his back pocket, Mike McCord has a $500 billion budget that he'll be able to pull out?
It's almost certain.
A wonderful Federal News Countdown, friends. Thank you very much for doing it today. Excellent job. Nora Bensahel of American University, Brian Clark of CSBA. All of their stories archived at federalnewsradio.com, and the Federal News Countdown returns next Friday on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio.
WFED Washington, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas.